Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to today's Football Times from These Football Times, a Franz Beckenbauer and Mario Zagallo special. It's sad news that we lost both within such a short space of time in recent days. Joining me today, the morning crew, as we've dubbed ourselves here. It's the way forward, recording podcasts during the day when everyone else is at work. Welcome, Dave Bowler.
Morning, Stephen. Well, it's good to be here and not so good to be here, given the subject matter, a couple more of the giants of the game, the people who built the game, I suppose, for many of us have passed away. So I think, as you say, we need to mark that passing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Beckenbauer's such a, you know, going to Beckenbauer first, didn't realise quite how ill he was, you know, and had been. And I think, you know, for me, it's that kind of, I don't know, immortalisation of players. And we were chatting just before we started recording on how certain players, how certain footballing figures set the benchmark. And I think we're still drawn to those. You know, we look at players now and say, yeah, you know, you're not a Beckenbauer, or you're not, or you know, that's who you're trying to be, and you can draw parallels to certain players, and it's that, you know, that I don't know, inspiration that contemporary players and players in between different eras as well, you know, they've grown up watching, and you can see it passed down the generations, and you can still see today elements of Franz Beckenbauer in so many players. I mean, I'm lucky enough to watch Virgil van Dijk play every week. And absolutely love it. I was lucky enough to watch Alan Hansen strut his stuff, you know. And you know, these were players that had that, I don't know, Beckenbauer-esque kind of take to the game. But you have to go back to Beckenbauer to find that original source for the inspiration. And I'm sure there was someone that inspired him. But you know, Beckenbauer, you know, such an intriguing, just to do the number crunch, you know, almost 600 games for Bayern Munich, who he walked away from at the age of 31 to, you know, join the NASL and New York Cosmos and all of that. You know, he scored 75 times, you know, for someone who was predominantly, you know, sweeper, central defender, whatever you want to call him, you know, and it tends to go forgotten or fall under the radar. He started out as an attacking midfielder as well. Now, if you look at his stats as a 19, 20-year-old, I think he scores about 16 goals in the promotion-winning campaign to go up to the Bundesliga. You know, there are a lot of people necessarily know the facts behind the formation of the Bundesliga and how Bayern were kind of, you know, cut adrift in the formation of it, because 1860 Munich were the bigger, you know, Munich club, and they were trying to split it, you know, geographically a lot more evenly.
They've had their revenge since, though, haven't they?
And they've had their revenge very much since. But yeah, I mean, Beckenbauer, I think he scored about 16 goals in that regional league season that saw them win promotion. And international terms as well. He scored, I think, 14 goals international level. Half of those came in the calendar year of 1966, when he was playing his football essentially as attacking midfielder. You know, 103 appearances for West Germany across the breadth of club and international football. He scored over 100 goals. You know, these are incredible figures. Played in two World Cup finals, two European Championship finals. You know, he won the hat-trick of European Cups. You know, he was twice European Footballer of the Year, twice won the Ballon d'Or, you know, in Kicker magazine's fabled Team of the Year. He was included in their Team of the Year for 12 consecutive years. Went and pioneered stuff in the NASL with Pele, you know, came back and, you know, even won a Bundesliga in a Hamburg shirt, you know, playing, you know, as a, you know, cameo roles here and there in 81, 82. But, you know, the Bundesliga title that queued them up to be able to win the European Cup a year later, after he'd gone back to New York. Dave, I lived the era of Beckenbauer, the coach, less so the player. I do remember him as a Hamburg player, and obviously so much about the NASL. So, World of Sport used to show a lot of NASL, especially during the summer months, you know, to fill a bit of space. And bizarre, you know, we talked on a podcast recently about how Martin Peters will always be a Norwich City player to me, because I remember him being a Norwich City player. You know, I only know him as a World Cup winning player, a Tottenham player, a West Ham player, via grainy footage on YouTube or photos and all that. You know, so to me, you know, Beckenbauer, his Bayern Munich days pass me by and his West Germany days pass me by. But, you know, Dave, you'll remember those Bayern Munich days and those successes and West Germany as well.
I do indeed. I mean, it's fascinating that we talk about Beckenbauer in this sense because, I mean, all of the other players, and some we've lost, obviously, in recent times, Pelé, Bobby Charlton, Maradona a few years back, Cruyff a few years back. The ones that roll off the tongue as the greats, you know, the greatest of all times, they're nearly all goal scorers, goal creators. And Beckenbauer, I think, is, I don't know, possibly unique, really, in that he spent most of his career, for, you know, those goal figures, notwithstanding what you've just gone through, but he spent most of his career in a defensive-ish role. And Maldini, perhaps, since then, has had the same kind of impact, but not very many defenders are the ones that we sort of think of as being amongst the pantheon of the great players. I was thinking about this last night, really, and in a sense, you may not agree, but Beckenbauer is the logical conclusion of the deep-lying centre-forward. In a way, I mean, yeah, the Hungarians in 1953, the deep line centre forward, and gradually, in a way, Beckenbauer took that all the way back to central defence and beyond. Because, you know, as you say, he started off as a goal scorer, as an attacking midfielder. He had all of those qualities, but by going further and further back in the team, he had all that room, he had all that space to work in. He had the opportunity to get on the ball, to bring the ball forward. I think it was David Turner in one of the Mount Rushmores that we did recently who said, you know, that by having Beckenbauer in the team, you effectively had a 12th man because he was playing two positions at once. He was giving you more in central defence and more in central midfield at the same time. And there's not many footballers that we can talk about in that sense. I think, you know, he will, from our generation, he will always be the footballer rather than the coach for all the massive success he then had as a coach of West Germany and so on. But, I mean, he was emblematic of that West German side at a time when you could actually quite like West Germany, which wasn't the case by the time you got to the 80s and the 90s, where it was just getting really tedious that they won everything, they were in every final and all of that. I think in the 70s, late 60s and 70s, they were slightly more likeable, although perhaps the 1974 World Cup final put pay to that. But, the, you know, as you say, you know, guys like Van Dijk now, it's that elegance on the ball that, you know, the time that he has, that ability to see passes and to see angles that other players can't see. And I mean, you know, there's always that great quote about Dennis Bergkamp that for the great players, the seconds last longer. And that was definitely the case for Beckenbauer. There was never any sense that Franz Beckenbauer was under pressure, that he was being hurried, that he was harried down by anybody. You know, I mean, nowadays we talk about the high press and all that stuff. I don't think Franz Beckenbauer would have a great deal of problem with that kind of stuff. He'd just pick his way through it. He'd pick his passes. He was just, you know, one of those great cerebral footballers, I think. And that was the gift that he brought to late 60s, early 70s football, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, a player like that as well, it's the, I don't know, the calm that they exude. It's the influence that they have on the rest of the team. But in Beckenbauer, you know, if you just look at West Germany and his influence there, you know, World Cup semi-final winning goal, you know, a couple of goals on the way to the final. That first goal in the comeback against England in 1970, the through ball he puts in to set in motion the goal that sends West Germany through to the 74 final. You know, the icon image of him strapped up in the 1970 semi-final with the dislocated shoulder. Just utterly iconic. I think even down to, you know, beating the Dutch in the 1974 final, I think when you see him lift the trophy, the joy on his face, you know, having you know, Uwe Seeler having been the captain in 66 and 1970 tends to go forgotten that Beckenbauer captained West Germany at just one World Cup, 1974, and all that pressure as host nation as well. You know, his influence on what was a collective of very talented players, you know, is astronomical.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think he's kind of inextricably linked with Johan Cruyff, isn't he? You know, that early 70s European football, it was those two were the dominant figures, I suppose. You know, Bobby Charlton had gone there, Manchester United were on the way, and George Best had sort of moved on from there. Liverpool hadn't come through to their sort of peak in the late 70s. So early 70s European football, it was Ajax and it was Bayern Munich, and those two were the emblems of those two sides. And there's something about Johan Cruyff where he doesn't need to win anything to be Johan Cruyff. if you know what I mean. The fact that the Dutch didn't win the 1974 World Cup doesn't really matter in the sense of Cruyff. I think with Beckenbauer, if they hadn't won the 1974 World Cup, something would have been missing from his career. I think with Cruyff, it's less important because of the way that the Dutch played in that World Cup and the total football arrival and all of that sort of stuff. I think Beckenbauer was a magnificent footballer. He was a leader, more of a leader than Cruyff in that sense, in terms of galvanising the team. And I think that had to end with a trophy. And as you say, that 1974 World Cup final, when he does pick up the cup, there's something appropriate about that. I know I can hear Gary Thacker now banging his head against the table. but I think there is something appropriate about the fact that Beckenbauer was the one that won that summer. And I think his legacy needed that. And perhaps that's partly because, as I said earlier, because he's a defender, predominantly a defender. That winning the trophy brings that bit of glamour and that iconic moment to it. Whereas, you know, Cruyff, you've got all sorts of other things. But, you know, I mean, we talk about total footballers being the Dutch thing. I mean, if you go back to that 1972 dismantling of England by West Germany in the Nations Cup, as it still was then, I think. Beckenbauer is, we all talk about Gunter Netzer and the way he played on that day, but I mean, Beckenbauer is every bit as influential in that game as Netzer is. I mean, he's the one that enables Netzer to go and do what he does and to pick England apart. But it's just that he's got that sort of air of inevitability about him, I think, Franz Beckenbauer, that if Beckenbauer's in the side, things will come right at the end, because there's never any sense of panic. And that was always the German thing, wasn't it? You know, they could be losing with 5 minutes to go and you still thought they were going to win. They didn't always win, but I mean, you still thought that they were going to come through it and do it. And I think a lot of that stems from Beckenbauer's personality as much as his ability. I think that's the crucial thing. The great players, you know, that we've talked about, that they're the ones that have got that personality that goes with great ability, and that radiates around the team. And Beckenbauer, in that sense, was one of the great leaders. Although, as you say, only had the one World Cup as captain. But that's why, for me, he will always be the player rather than the coach for all the success that came later, because he was always the most important player on the pitch, whatever game it was that was being played. I think.
Are you bringing Cruyff into that conversation, because they do. Inextricably go hand in hand, you know, and you know, Cruyff was a rock star footballer, you know, the esoteric rock star footballer without a shadow of a doubt. You know, Beckenbauer was the conductor in comparison. You know, like, as you say, all of that space to be able to dictate from the back and, you know, to stride forward, you know, and an explosive right foot as well. You know, and he could use his left foot and, you know, two-footed, but that the strength in that right foot was unreal. He could hit balls from distance, goals from distance, the eye for goal. Yeah, and it's the abiding image of Beckenbauer, the player, in my mind's eye, you know, having watched the footage, you know, over and over, over the years. It's him lifting kind of like World Cup 74, the European Championship in 72, you know, that hat-trick of European Cups, and, you know, the iconic Bundesliga trophy, the Salatschüssel, which just always looks absolutely brilliant, knocks the socks off the Premier League trophy, which I think was designed by a 10-year-old, wasn't it? A competition was made, wasn't it? And it was kind of like, just everything that, and it's the kits as well, you know, throwing the kits, throwing the style of the 70s, you know, it all looked, you know, it was like the streets of San Francisco every time, you know. It's kind of like I'm lifting a trophy at 4:45 and you know, dancing the night away, but in between solving some kind of crime and driving around in an iconic sports car as well. He just exuded style. I mean, moving on to his coaching career, polarising in that. Nothing polarising about his playing career, but plenty to be polarised about. Beckenbauer the coach, Beckenbauer the administrator, the crowd surfer of World Cups. There was thought to be one. Well, that sleight of hand in terms of taking the host nation candidature. Beckenbauer, the coach, you know, stepped in 1984, 6 years in charge, took them to two World Cup finals, won the second, which was a I think it was a poor final rather than the dire final people tend to remember it as. Yeah, I mean, he took over from Jupp Derwall. They've just been knocked out of the European Championships and the group stages, massively uncharacteristic. You know, took an ageing team to the 1986 World Cup final. There were plenty of 30-somethings in that side. And then over the course of the next 4 years, via being host of the 1988 European Championship, had to rebuild. You know, he lost, you know, goalkeeper. You know, Tony Schumacher was gone, you know, in acrimony within a couple of months beyond the 1986 World Cup. Virtually, you know, Andres Bremer aside, Thomas Berthold lost an entire back line to retirement. Karl-Heinz Förster retired at 20, he was 27 at international level, extortionately young, really. He had to recreate that side and built this side around Lothar Matthäus and you know, kind of did what he did as a player as such in the, you know, Lothar Matthäus being a more attacking midfielder, he started to drop him deeper. He didn't quite deploy him in the defence that he would eventually go to and eventually, you know, be a sweeper, you know, himself, libero himself, as he began to age as a player, Matthäus. But, you know, that revamp of that side that eventually led to the 1990... I've often said it that, you know, World Cups are won by the deserving team, and 1990 West Germany were the best team at the 1990 World Cup. And there's another one for Gary Thacker to be smashing the whatever he's listening to this. I've seen him roll his eyes when I've said that before because of that England side that came so close to the final. But, you know, he did build something quite special with that West German team. But on the back of it being a side that had lost all of the, you know, the Paul Breitners, the Uli Stielikers, the Sepp Meyers, you know, Tony Schumacher had gone. You know, there was no Gerd Müller, you know, in this era. You know, Karl-Heinz Rummenigge was gone within, you know, by before the end of 86. He lost all of those icons and had to build a side that was, I don't know, that balanced, but it was inhibited by that set of players who were that next level of I don't know, talent down from the ones that he'd played with.
And it's a massively difficult task. I mean, you know, you look at pretty well any nation that's had World Cup success, and particularly prolonged success, when that generation and a half, I suppose, comes to an end, recreating a team is incredibly difficult. You know, I mean, Brazil, after all that success that they had in the 50s through the 70s, it took them forever, you know, to find a, I mean, even to find a real quality team. I suppose you're looking at 1982, and then to win the World Cup is another dozen years on from that. You know, Argentina have had fallow periods. England have had a fallow half century. You know, it is not easy, you know, because you are always living in the shadow of that greatness, you know, of that success that you've had. And, you know, you can't help but point to, yeah, well, he's good, but he's not Gerd Müller, is he? He's not Beckenbauer, is he? He's not Sepp Meyer, is he? He's not, you know. That's a real tough. And it's with West Germany, as it was at the time, it was even more difficult because everybody just automatically by then had put them as favourites for any competition that they ever entered, whether they, you know, before you'd bothered looking at what the team was, now they'd qualified or any of that stuff, they were the team that was going to win because they were West Germany. It was just an expected thing. I mean, West Germany was the economic miracle after the war. It was all that kind of stuff. So it was a dominant country in every kind of way. And to pick up the pieces of that and to build a brand new team, essentially, I mean, it's a massive achievement, and that's kind of, I suppose, in a sense, where his legacy becomes less loved, because he didn't do it the way Cruyff did it at Barcelona and played this marvellous sparkling football, which is perhaps easier as a club side because you're working with the players all the time and you can bring players in from all over the world and all of that. West Germany were, I always enjoyed watching West Germany in the 70s when Beckenbauer was playing. I mean, I quite like watching them in the late 80s, but they were certainly more mechanical. And mechanical is a terrible word, and I don't quite mean it in that sense, but they were a lot more efficient and ruthless and straight-jacketed, I suppose, in a sense. But they were incredibly efficient. They, you know, they knew what they were going to do. They believed in what they were going to do, and they kept doing what they were going to do right the way through. And, you know, Beckenbauer was always a great believer that would prevail in the end. And Alex Ferguson, you know, he was in his early days at Aberdeen. he would always, whenever there was time off, he would go and watch the Bundesliga because he loved German football and he loved that relentlessness and that belief system that, you know, you keep doing what you do. And in the end, if you keep playing to the 90th minute or the 95th minute or wherever it is, it will prevail. And that was very much the Beckenbauer thing, wasn't it? You know, but it just was. It didn't capture the imagination in the same way as that side did in the 70s. And then, you know, then you come into all sorts of other philosophical arguments about football. I mean, is winning more important now than any of those things? And at what point did that change? I think it changed sort of in the 80s. You know, we stopped being, well, we want to be entertained. And then it was, we want to be entertained, but we got to win as well. And that, those two are tough things to put together. And I think that's why, you know, I mean, we are in the twilight of the gods, aren't we? You know, Beckenbauer's gone, Bobby Charlton a few months back, Pele last year. There aren't people like that. I mean, yeah, perhaps that's because I'm a dinosaur, but the ones who followed, there are very few beyond that who have that same feel. You know, we were talking about this just before we started. Yeah, these guys are the Beatles. They're the Elvis Presley. And there's, after that, you've got, you know, you have Led Zeppelin. People love Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd, and that's fine. But they're not the Beatles. And Franz Beckenbauer is one of the Beatles. And I don't know that when, you know, the stars of the 80s go, it'll be the same feel. I don't think it will somehow. And, you know, they were the television era, weren't they, as well? They were the first ones being captured by television, whereas, you know, the likes of Puskas and Di Stefano and Finney and Matthews and whatever, very poorly served by television. I think, you know, these guys were the first ones to be seen around the world, and they made that impact, and that will never go away, I don't think.
Absolutely. You know, I think, as we were saying before the podcast, players like Beckenbauer, you know, Pele, you know, Cruyff, all of those were what we still set as the benchmark, you know, to measure the players that come, you know, beyond that. And I'm sure for younger people, it'll be completely different. It'll be, you know, those to come will be, you know, measured against the Lionel Messis of the world. But yeah, you know, Beckenbauer, I mean, just going back to his coaching days, I mean, he was kind of unloved a little bit on home soil in that respect. He took a percentage playing team to the 1986 World Cup final. They'd won one, drawn one, lost one in the group stage, been outclassed by Denmark in the group stage, come back against Scotland from one down, snatched a late equaliser against Uruguay. You know, it was all a bit untidy. A last 16 victory against Morocco that was won late in the game against the Morocco team that had played some great football in the group stages, but then kind of went a bit rabbit in the headlights and you know, took a safety-first approach to playing West Germany. And then it was, penalties against Mexico. And I think everyone had wanted France to get their revenge in the 86 semi-final. It wasn't to be. They actually played some very good football in the 86 semi-final. But then kind of made themselves likeable in the way that they played in green in the 86 final. Had that comeback from two down, made it an interesting final, set it up for Burushaga's grandstand winner, you know, and all of that. But what I find interesting is that, you know, then you get that 2 years of friendlies and, you know, you're not really tested. And that I think there was a sense of doubt in the German public over just how good or not they were. You know, is travails in trying to find a libero of purpose to play the role that he played as a player. And there can be no greater microscope, I think, in football there than being judged by Beckenbauer as a sweeper for West Germany. And I know Matthias Hergai struggled massively with it. You know, and Klaus Argenthaler eventually filled the role by the time they won the World Cup. But I'm currently writing a book about the 1988 European Championships, Stew out in the middle of the year. And right, bizarrely, when the news came through yesterday, I was writing the West German chapter at the minute. And you know, reading the articles and all the incidentals and stuff like that through the archives. And you know, Beckenbauer's name was booed when his name came up on the electronic scoreboard prior to the opening game against Italy. You know, there was scepticism towards Beckenbauer, the coach. You know, he took them to, it was a last-minute winner from Van Basten in the semi-final that denied them a place in the final of the 88 European Championships, and then to win the World Cup. And by the time he walks away, you know, he's won the public over to the point that they never really take to Bertie Vogts, the coach. You know, they kind of were kind of sceptical of Beckenbauer, the coach, but then mourned the fact that he'd gone, you know, by post 1990. And you look at the Germany until the more recent coming of Germany, you know, up to winning the World Cup in 2014 anyway. And that fallow period by their standards, yes, they win the European Championship in 96, but you know, it's seen as a poor Germany by that. You know, and then you're looking at them being dismantled by Bulgaria in the quarterfinals of the 94 World Cup, by Croatia. Quite emphatically, that was a jaw-dropper to lose 3-0 to Croatia in the 1998 World Cup semi-final, to be, you know, drummed out of the Euro 2000 in Rancor in the group stages, even beaten by an abject England in those group stages. A relatively poor Germany, again, made the World Cup by hook or crook in the 2002, missing out on them to play any of the serious nations until they lose to Brazil in the final. You know, more, you know, knocked out in the group stage of the Euro 2004. It's not until Klinsmann that Germany kind of reclaim themselves. There's a decade and a half of near downtime post Beckenbauer there. Again, his influence on, by whatever means it was, getting the World Cup to Germany in 2006. You know, again, he kind of helped propel, you know, German football back onwards again. You know, from certain the dark days of losing 5-1 to England in Munich in 2001.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the sort of the lead into the 2006 World Cup, and there was lots of talk about, well, would Germany even get out of the group? And, you know, what a terrible World Cup it would be if the host nation didn't go all the way, and there's no way that this German side are up to the task and all of that. And as you say, that was kind of the rebirth of German football. But as you say, 16 years really of, certainly in German terms, mediocrity after the 1990 World Cup and Beckenbauer departing the scene. I mean, he was never a person assailed by self-doubt, I wouldn't have thought. Certainly that was the impression that you always got from Franz Beckenbauer. You know, he believed utterly in himself and in what he was doing. And that rubs off on people, I guess. But, you know, I come back to what we were saying earlier. To have a side as great as that West Germany was through the late 60s into the 70s, and then to lift it and do it again almost immediately, you know, with another new team after, you know, perhaps one poor tournament or something. That's an incredible achievement, because there's just so much militating against it. Because, you know, you think back to Alf Ramsey. I always think it's far more difficult for an international side to be rebuilt than a club side, because, you know, when were you ever going to drop Bobby Charlton? When were you ever going to drop Jeff Hurst, until the point at which you had to, because they were too old? Whereas at club level, you can introduce, you know, obviously you play four times as many games. You can introduce players bit by bit through the season. You can't do that in international football. You don't play as many games, and all the games that you play are important games by and large. You know, you haven't got any time to experiment. You haven't got any time to mess around. And when you've got a whole group that's finishing in and around the same time, as you inevitably will if you've had a successful national team, all of a sudden you've got to replace half a dozen players who are great players and who are beloved by the nation, and who inevitably whoever comes in isn't going to be as good, and you're not going to get the same results, and the manager's an idiot. And that, you know, that's how we are. I mean, that's how the press is. That's how we are as football fans. It's inevitable. And then all of a sudden, of course, you get the one result and you're a genius again. And that's, you know, that's the nature of football. It's so difficult for a great footballer to have a great second act as a manager or as a coach. There's very few that have done it. You know, all the ones that we talk about as the great footballers, very, very few have gone on and then been really, really top-class coaches as well. Whether that's a personality flaw, whether that's just because it's such a completely different skill set, I don't know. But I mean, yeah, in some ways, I always, when you look at Glenn Hoddle, I mean, players I know that played for Glenn Hoddle at various times, they always used to say his problem was that he didn't realise that we weren't all as good as Glenn Hoddle. And, you know, you would think that might have been an issue with Beckenbauer, because he was so completely composed and he believed in himself. And you know, you could see the arrogance in the way he played. But to be able to then have a team that wins a World Cup, gets to a World Cup final, gets to a European semi-final. Clearly, that isn't part of his makeup when he became a coach. Clearly, players wanted to play for him, and he understood their foibles and the fact that they weren't all Gerd Müller and Franz Beckenbauer and Sepp Maier. That's an amazing skill from a management point of view, and you know, makes what he did even more special. You know, only three guys have been a player and a manager winning a World Cup. That speaks volumes, doesn't it? I think.
Certainly does. It certainly does. I mean, to walk away from West Germany as well as coach in 1990, he never, you know, took to club management particularly well. A short spell at Marseille, and just over half a season back in charge of Bayern, which, you know, he saw them over the line for another Bundesliga title there. But Beckenbauer's his legacy is all to do with what he did with the ball at his feet, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. I think so. I mean, he was an absolutely magnificent player. He's one of those ones that changed the way we think about football. And there's not very many who've done that over the years. You know, as we said, the way that he played the game as a sweeper, an attacking sweeper, which, you know, was revolutionary, I suppose, at that point in time. He turned football upside down in that sense. And I mean, and again, I come back to the Beatles thing. You've got to know when to stop. That's, you know, the Beatles' legacy remains intact because they stopped when they did, and they didn't do what the Rolling Stones did. You know, and people love the Rolling Stones, and still millions of people go and see them and all of that. But the Rolling Stones haven't made a decent recording on a very long time, let's say. The Beatles' legacy was never sort of tarnished by that kind of thing. And it's the same with Franz Beckenbauer. He finished his football career pretty much at the top and then went away to America to do what he did there. As a coach, he won the World Cup and stopped. That must take huge self-discipline, even when you've got all the money in the world that you need and all of that, to walk away from something as addictive as winning stuff and being lauded by your country and all of that. That takes a lot of self-discipline. We can talk about 2006 as a separate thing, but in terms of on the field, he never soiled his reputation by being around too long, either as a player or as a coach. And you know, again, that's an object lesson, I think.
Absolutely. And moving on to our other icon that we've lost in recent days, Mario Zagallo, an intriguing character. The only man, you know, prior to Beckenbauer to have won the World Cup as both player and manager. Didier Deschamps has gone on to do it since with France. Zagallo, again, another polarising character. Brazilian, you know, he led the most iconic of Brazilian World Cup winning sides in 1970. He was played a playing role in probably the most fluid World Cup success in 1958, that first success, you know, part of that side. A disciplined attacker, you know, but one who would go back and defend, you know, very much the balance to Garrincha in that respect. You know, won a hatful of Rio State championships as a player with both Flamengo and Botafogo. You know, went on to epic coaching, you know, successes. You know, led both, you know, Botafogo, Fluminense, and Flamengo to Rio State championships, a national championship, Botafogo. You know, took over that 1970 World Cup squad from Yao Saldana. You know, not long before the World Cup. You know, brought in a degree of pragmatism that maybe made the difference to them winning the 1970 World Cup and not. But also a man that was arguably inspired, not the right word, but he was the man in charge of Brazil at the 74 World Cup, where there was a lot more rancor. Now, that was a Brazil side that were on European soil and aiming to get the punches in first, you know, in so many respects. The previous World Cup that had been on European soil in 66, Brazil had been kicked out of it figuratively and literally in England. A World Cup that Zagallo wasn't at, you know, that was beyond him as a player. Vicente Fiola, the man who had led them to World Cup success in 58, was back in charge in 66, and always got the feeling that it was those experiences for Fiola and Brazil in 66 that put so much shade on his approach to the 1974 World Cup. He would come back later on, you know, technical director slash assistant, you know, to Pereira at the 94 World Cup again, you know, a pragmatic World Cup win, back as coach to lead them into 98, having to juggle the Ronaldos and Rivaldos and all of those magnificent players of the late 90s, you know, and the upset of the 98 World Cup and all everything that surrounds that. Zagallo, again, another fascinating character. You know, that stretch between the 1958 World Cup win as a player and the 1998 World Cup final defeat as coach, via everything else, you know, we've only got a short time to do this as such, but you know, Zagallo, the balance between light and shade there.
I mean, in some senses, he is the biggest figure of the World Cup. You know, given the longevity and you know the involvement with the teams that he was involved in, it's an extraordinary breadth of experience. But as you say, I mean, it is both sides of the coin, isn't it? I mean, you know, the wonders of that period, that sort of 12-year period when Brazil won the three World Cups and the marvellous football that they played. And, you know, obviously he was an element in that team. But, you know, for somebody my age, I can't ever think of him as anything other than the 1970 World Cup team, because that was, you know, I just turned six. I was transfixed by that whole thing, because, you know, it was happening in the middle of the day and there'd be a lunchtime grandstand or something. I'd run home from school to watch this thing on the black and white telly that was having all these wavy lines going up and down it. And it was, you know, it was just mesmerising, the whole thing. And I suppose in a way he then represents that sea change in football that we were talking about a little bit earlier, where think about winning first. If you can win nicely, great, but think about winning first. And that sort of came, I suppose, in the 70s. And as you say, that 1974 World Cup, I mean, that was a very ugly Brazil. And I mean, you know, I was 10 by then, and I couldn't quite understand that this Brazilian team, who had been just so unbelievable to watch and just so incredibly exciting and thrilling and played all this marvellous football, it suddenly turned into this other thing. You know, 4 years later, what were they doing? I mean, okay, Pelé had gone and all that, but what was this stuff that they were doing? This isn't, you know, this isn't right. This is like, you know, this doesn't make any form of sense. Of course, you know, when you then read up and you learn about the 1966 World Cup finals, it makes more sense. And being in Europe and trying to perhaps have a more European style, I suppose, in a sense. I mean, that and then the subsequent period, the 94, kind of tarnishes his reputation in a way that you know, Beckenbauer, who we just talked about, wasn't tarnished in that sense. Because when you've had something that is absolute perfection like 1970, and then you serve up 1974's football, and you're involved with 1994's Brazil, that, you know, okay, I know by then 24 years they were desperate to win the World Cup, but I understand why they played the way they played and all of that. But at the same time, we're unfair in the things that we put on Brazil. We don't ask any other country to produce the same joyful moments that we demand of Brazil. I know, but life ain't fair, is it? And it kind of, you know, he did kind of spoil that legacy in that sense. I mean, that's why I'm looking forward to spoiler alert. We've got a centre circle with Gary Thacker, whose new book is about 1970 Brazil. I'm looking forward to that immensely because, you know, I can't hear enough about 1970 Mexico World Cup and Brazil winning it and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, you kind of want to turn away from that 1974 thing and the 1994. It's not Brazil, is it? You know, Brazil is that Carlos Alberto goal, which, as I've said umpteen times on these podcasts, is mankind's greatest ever achievement, far better than putting somebody on the moon. That goal, Carlos Alberto, that's it. You know, we might as well blow the planet up at that point because it's not getting any better.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, even within the rank of the 1974 World Cup, and there is a kind of hypnotic savagery, especially to that Netherlands game. You know, even goading the crowd as you've been sent off and all that type of stuff. Very, very un-Brazil as you know, we stereotypically demand them to be, as you say. You know, the very nature of how it went in 74, though, still had that great knock-on effect, is that Brazil had that sea change in wanting to go for what would eventually flourish or semi-flourish in 1982, you know, to hark back to, you know, the beautiful football of 58 in particular and 70. Yet he was still cast within that pragmatism. He wasn't for it, was he? You know, he remained for the discipline. I mean, an amazing character in you know, a fine player as well that, that tends to go forgotten. You know, to win two World Cups, you know, soft touch. And he went into the 1958 World Cup as being an outlier. He'd only played a couple of games. I think he'd only won his first cap, you know, a month or two before the 1958 World Cup. But he soon became, you know, such a, you know, a pivotal balance to Garrincha, you know, the excesses of Garrincha on the opposite flank. But in coaching terms, you know, it's unreal to consider that he spanned over 3.5 decades. His last act as a coach was a caretaker game in charge of Brazil in late 2002. You know, 36 years on from having taken up his first appointment with Botafogo. The changes in football from start to finish in terms of Zagallo's coaching and managerial career, it's unreal to consider.
Absolutely it is, and it is also the television era, isn't it? You know, I mean, we sort of seen him arrive in 58 with that Brazilian World Cup team, and that's the first one that you really seen film footage of, and there's some TV footage of it at the time, but, you know, that we've got on film properly that we can really enjoy. And then he goes right the way through that era. And I think TV is the biggest. This is another series. I think TV, more than anything, is the biggest impact on football in the last sort of 50, 60 years. I think it has changed the game in every possible way that we think about it, and will continue to do so. I've got no doubt about that. And so for him to have that career in parallel with television, really. And I think, you know, we look at football, you know, I've come to learn this over the years, but we look at football in a very different way to people who work in football, particularly players and coaches, because their livelihoods depend on it. And in the end, livelihoods depend on results. And ultimately, you know, players and managers and coaches will get results by whatever method they have to, because that keeps them in work. And, you know, everybody's got to eat. And I think that became has become more and more prevalent with the growth of television. And ironically, although television's there for the spectacle and it wants to be it wants us to be entertained and thrilled and excited, television has also made it more important to win than it's ever been. And that has had a knock-on effect on making football probably less thrilling and less exciting and less experimental, because people can't afford to take those risks. And I think you can probably see that in Zagallo's career. You know, you get through to that 1994 World Cup and, okay, he's an assistant and technical director. Brazil have got to win that World Cup, haven't they? You know, it's been 24 years. There's all those Nike sponsorships that depend on all of this and all that money and the pressure, because it's on television rather than just you're hearing from it 2 days later on newspaper reports and all of that. And inevitably, it must have an impact on his way of thinking. But equally, as you say, going back to the 58 World Cup, he's the one probably with the football brain in that team. You know, he's the foil to Garrincha on the other side. He's the one that, you know, recognises that this... Yeah. Ozzy Ardiles, when he was at the Albion, he always used to say, no worry, they score three, we score four. Lovely. Doesn't work every week, unfortunately. And you know, Zagallo was the one in that Brazilian team who was saying, right, okay, well, if he's going to spend all his time up there doing daft things, I'd better look after the shop a bit, you know, and be a bit more sensible. So, I mean, he always had that in his personality, but I think everybody in football has got forced down that line over the years of being more pragmatic, just because it's a bigger and bigger business and there are bigger and bigger sums of money on it. And that's a great shame, but equally, it's what's made football the biggest thing in the world, I suppose.
That's indeed. I mean, a great 50 minutes talking about two of the icons of the game, but also fascinating to consider, you know, the two sides of the coin of both of these characters. You know, Beckenbauer, you know, all that greatness. There was the questionable side of the coin, and Zagallo, you know, to be at the helm for football's most beautiful moment and most beautiful team, yet, you know, have that more, you know, greater kind of like shift towards the pragmatism that was probably more naturally him. Maybe was Zagallo possibly blessed to come into the Brazil job quite as late as he did in terms of 1970. Mm. You know, arguably far too much thinking time in the lead up to 74. 94, and maybe by 98 he's softening his approach and it's a bit more fluid by then, considering he's got a lot more autonomy, you know, post 1994, I think. You know, Zagallo kind of learned from himself as much as learned from football itself, maybe.
No, that's a great point. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, 1970, he didn't have much time to do a great deal, really, other than mould what he was given. And as you say, I suppose probably the backlash to that 1994 World Cup win. I mean, everybody was delighted, I think, that Brazil had finally won again. And then after that initial euphoria died down, there was a bit more. It was a bit more critically viewed, I suppose. And that's what you look at. And great coaches are always evolving, aren't they? You know, if you come out with your one idea in your first 5 years of coaching, well, you're not going to have a 10th year in coaching in all likelihood. And that flexibility and that adaptability is the hallmark of a great coach. Which let's face it, he certainly was. As I say, it's hard to think of anybody more significant in the history of the World Cup, really, in that sense, given the huge breadth of his. Of his involvement, 40 years, really, in World Cups. It's an amazing achievement, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's staggering. Yeah, absolutely staggering. So, to think from 1958 to 1998, you know, 40 years of being at the sharp end of World Cup relevancy is absolutely stunning. You know, Mario Zagallo, you know, a stunning, you know, his place in history, you know, completely, you know, assured without a shadow of a doubt. Dave, thank you so much for spending the time to talk about these two incredible characters that we've sadly lost in the last few days.
It's been a pleasure talking to you as ever, Stephen.
All that leaves me to do is please say to join us again on today's Football Times and any of our myriad of podcast series. This was another podcast from these Football Times. Please join us again. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.